On October 19, 2017, a Canadian astronomer named Robert Warrick was reviewing images captured by a telescope known as Pan-STARRS 1 when he noticed something strange. A dot of light that caught Warrick's attention was moving at more than four times the speed of asteroids at almost 200,000 miles per hour. Instead of swinging around the sun in an elliptical path, it was zipping away more or less in a straight line. The bright dot, astronomers concluded, was something never seen before. Elizabeth Colbert in The New Yorker, January 25, 2021. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Elizabeth Colbert, in her New Yorker article, asks if signs of extraterrestrial life have been found. Colbert says astronomers agreed it was something never seen before. It was called Oumuamua, Hawaiian basically meaning scout. Colbert reports that Harvard astrophysicist Avi Loeb, along with Shmuel Biley, argued in an equation-dense paper that an interstellar object behaving as Oumuamua was the work of an alien civilization. An astounding announcement that attracted global attention. Other astronomers demurred in no uncertain terms by saying the claims in the paper are an insult to honest scientific inquiry. Loeb responded by writing, "Extraterrestrial, the first sign of intelligent life beyond Earth," and likened the negative reception he received to that of Galileo when he stated that the Earth orbited the sun. Colbert outlines the argument that followed Loeb's claim. My guest to help us understand the significance of Oumuamua and the controversy over Loeb and his proclamations, as well as what this disagreement has to say about our current culture and the ideas of evidence and truth, is astronomer Grant Wilson, professor in the astronomy department at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. In the spirit of full disclosure, Grant Wilson is my son. Grant, welcome to Delmarva Today.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back.
You were on the program 3 years ago to talk about leading a team of astronomers in building Toltec, the next generation millimeter wavelength polarimetric camera to conduct surveys in star formation and galaxy evolution. Take a minute, if you would, to update us on Toltec and tell us what you're working on now.
Oh, well, I'd be happy to. It's been a busy 3 years, I'll tell you that. And in an eventful one set of years as well. So we've built the camera. We have the camera. Actually, I was with it in my lab today. And the fact that it's at my lab and not at the Large Millimeter Telescope in Mexico is the bad news. Good news is the camera's doing great, and we're really happy with the way it performs, how everything looks. We've been given, now this is the silver lining of the pandemic, we've been given this extra time to actually work on understanding the camera in a deeper way than we would have had time to had we gone straight to the telescope. But of course, as everyone has been dealing with the pandemic over the past year, so have we, and that has ground our progress towards the telescope to a halt until conditions improve, both in the United States, where we can get vaccines, and then again in Mexico, where we can safely go to Mexico and install the camera on the telescope. So I think overall, we've been held back by the pandemic, but I think overall the community of people interested in using Toltec more excited than ever, and we continue to find new applications for the camera, even though we haven't even seen first light with it yet. So I think the picture is rosy, but stay tuned, and hopefully this year we'll be installing it, commissioning it, and then even offering it to American and Mexican astronomers to use.
Well, is this the second version of Toltec, or is this the original camera that built?
This is the original version of Toltec. We had a predecessor that we built about a decade ago, about 15 years ago now, called Aztec. But Toltec is about 50 times bigger in terms of its abilities to image the sky. And then it also images the sky in three different wavelengths. So we can make nice color images of the sky from which we can learn a lot.
Well, what do you hope to learn?
Oh, wow. Well, this is great that
we're
talking about
this. Well, you can narrow it down.
Well, this is great that we're talking about this first, because it is nowhere in what I'm going to talk about.
Right.
Is what we're going to talk about later, which is aliens and objects that are visiting our solar systems from other solar systems. I work on a much bigger scale. My areas of expertise are now in how stars form and how galaxies form, and some of the biggest, most massive galaxies in the entire universe, how they form, how they evolve over time, and what they become once they get to the present day.
Fascinating, Grant. I look forward actually to having you back again to talk about these big galaxies that that you're looking at with Toltec. Well, Grant, in her article, Colbert reports that an astronomer at Ohio State wrote about the proclamation that Oumuamua was alien made by saying basically, no, Oumuamua is not an alien spaceship. And the authors of the paper, this is rather nasty, the authors of the paper insult honest scientific inquiry to even suggest it. And then Colbert goes on to state a comment from another astronomer by saying, can we talk about how it sounds like a petty argument among astrophysicists, actually, about how annoying it is that this Harvard professor promotes speculative theories about alien origins of Oumuamua, forcing the rest of us to do the scientific groundwork of walking back these comments. Well, what would lead these astronomers and astrophysicists to speak out so strongly about the proclamation that Oumuamua is in fact an alien-made object?
Right. So, all right, first let me say I can't speak for these astronomers or for Avi Loeb and what they think when they say or write certain things, but I can say that scientists can be petty and can be quite biting in their criticism sometimes. And frankly, that's part of what we do. And that's, I think that's okay. We're all adults, we can handle it. That said, why might, a claim of alien provenance of Oumuamua really raised the hackles of a lot of people. And I guess it, me too. I think it comes from the fact that when we do science professionally, especially when we do a kind of fundamental science like astronomy, then we have a big responsibility. And we have a responsibility to play by the process of science, the scientific method, which, you know, isn't quite what y'all learn in school, but is similar. We have a process by which we do things. We have forums where we have arguments, and we are supposed to, we are trained to have some humility and obey what the mathematics and the probabilities tell us when we make our proclamations.
And let me interrupt you for a moment and ask you, we hear today a lot about following the science, particularly in terms of this pandemic. We need to follow the science. Remind us, if you would, what is the scientific method? What are the rules you scientists follow when you do your work?
Right. Well, I'll give you my take on it. And I don't like the word method. I actually like the word process, because I think it's really important to understand that the scientific process is a never-ending process. And the part, and this gets back to what we were talking about before with these other scientists and why they might be a little unhappy, the process is by its very nature slow. Okay, so here's how the process works. We collect data. When we collect data, it is never cut and dry what the data is telling us. I like to tell my students that all the easy problems were solved a long time ago. We're only interested in hard problems because those are the ones that we're most capable of digging into and getting to the bottom of. All right. So the data is never cut and dry. And so that leads there to be different interpretations of the data, which is great. So the people who collect the data, write a paper, write their interpretation, and then that paper is submitted to a journal where it's refereed, which means that peers of those people who are supposed to be disinterested, maybe in the field, but certainly not on the same team, will rate that paper, send the paper back for clarifications, ask difficult questions of the authors, ask for many clarifications, and then eventually the paper gets published. And that process, I've been involved with projects where for a paper that appeared in the journal Nature, which is one of the most prestigious journals there is in science, a paper we wrote, that whole process took about 5 years. Okay, so it's a long process, or it can be a very long process. Once the paper comes out, or once the data becomes available, other scientists are welcomed and encouraged to take that same data, add data to it, bring along different interpretations. And that's when the fun really begins, because then in a series of papers and a series of backs and forths that are all supposed to be refereed, you get a conversation that sounds a lot like two or three or four sides arguing, but it's a conversation nonetheless, and we work it out. And how long does it take to work out? Well, sometimes it takes a decade, sometimes it takes many decades. And if you look back in the history of science, you see that happening over and over and over again. Now, one of the neat things about it is that there's a bit of capitalism involved, only it's not money, it's reputation and ego and position, what university positions you get. And so young scientists are highly incentivized to look at older results, to look at previous results and find problems with them and improve on them. And so you see young scientists going at the heels of the older people in the field all the time. And it's great to watch, because you get very clever people come along and flip over ideas and take things along. And so it's turbulent, it's a process, but as long as we play by these rules, I think we make a lot of progress. And it's slow, but the arc of the trajectory is absolutely in the direction of learning more and understanding more about our world and our universe.
Well, I'm going to ask you to apply this method to your work in astronomy in a moment. And I know you're an astronomer and not a, a disease expert, but can you tell us just very briefly how this method applies to understanding this pandemic that we're dealing with?
Okay, so yeah, so here, and again, I'm not an infectious disease person or even know much about a lot about biology, but I will say that the rapidity with which the pandemic came on does not lend itself well to the scientific process, because there, as I was saying, the process is slow, and it involves all these checks and balances, but it plays out over many, many years. And in the early part of the pandemic, honestly, people were looking, they were very quickly trying to look back at previous pandemics and other forms of infectious coronaviruses, in fact. But it's very difficult because this was a brand new coronavirus. And so people had to discern what its properties are, how it spreads, and what the best modes of protecting oneself were from it. And frankly, they got it wrong early on. It took a long time, I think way too long, for the WHO to admit that it was airborne. And of course, the most infamous proclamation was when Dr. Fauci told people not to worry about masks. And so that, you know, interestingly, I'm not sure that early proclamation cost many lives, but I think the bigger effect was the sociological effect of us having to turn that advice over and now say, oh no, now we want you to wear masks. And I think that gave a big section of the population pause and went, wait, do you guys really know what you're talking about or not? Now, had this been, you know, just left to the standard scientific method, we'd all have coronavirus now because we'd only just be getting.
So they went very, very fast. They went very, very fast.
Yeah, they did. They did.
With this, but still, it was data driven, and we did analyze the data and try to use the data to the best that we could.
But to be fair, and we can bring this back to Oumuamua, the early data, and this is arguable depending on whose data you look at, but the early data in the coronavirus again had to be interpreted. And not surprisingly, people took different conclusions from that early data. I think we're seeing the same thing with Oumuamua. So let's talk just a moment about how quickly people had to respond to that, because that's a story in itself. So Oumuamua is, I don't know, if you look at the artist's impressions of it, it looks like a big cigar-shaped rock. It comes tumbling through our solar system, is detected after it's already done a turn around the sun, which is from the sun's, bent by the sun's gravity. And as it's on the other side of the sun, heading away from us at 200,000 miles per hour or so, as you said, the Pan-STARRS folks picked it up, which itself is a great discovery. And then very quickly, they were able to get time on the Hubble Space Telescope, the Spitzer Space Telescope, the ALMA telescope, to try to detect it. But moving so quickly, Oumuamua, and being so small, frankly, Oumuamua became invisible or too faint to be observed very quickly. And so we're left with a glimpse of data, unlike the coronavirus, where we've had, you know, now a full year of continuous data flowing in, where we've been able to refine our models and get better and better at understanding what this disease is, at least now, until we have the new variants. So this was a tough problem. And I think that, you know, again, this very rapid appearance and disappearance and very small amount of data provided an opening for someone to be able to say, oh, well, I think it was an alien ship. And look, you can't prove me wrong because it's gone. It's too faint now.
So the two astronomers that I mentioned, or astrophysicists that Colbert mentions in her piece are reacting to the fact that there is just not enough data here, not enough information, not enough time to study what we've seen to make such a shattering pronouncement.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that it's also, it's not only that that it happened fast, but it's that there are plenty of other possibilities for Oumuamua's provenance that have nothing to do with aliens. I mean, in the fact is, we expect these kinds of things to be moving through our galaxy, and we expect that we should run into them. Now, I say that the proof will be in the pudding when we look with yet new eyes. You know, Pan-STARRS is still working. We're going to look with the Vera Rubin telescope, which will make astounding images of the full sky every two nights. And it will be very interesting to see what we find, what kind of brothers and sisters Oumuamua has out there that are coming in and out of our solar system. There's a big effect in astronomy, which is centered around selection effects. And it's the sense of it is, what conspires to make something easy or difficult to observe at any particular time? And Oumuamua happened to come sort of into a sweet spot near the sun, which made it easier to pick up. It was, and what I think what clouds the interpretation quite a bit is that it's actually quite small compared to the kinds of objects we thought we would see come in and out of our solar system, and compared to objects that we typically study in our solar system. So at its size, the kinds of objects we know about and we study, and when I say we, I don't mean me, I mean other astronomers, but the kinds of objects we study are all what we call near-Earth objects. So they're objects in our vicinity in the solar system. Anything further out, let's say beyond Jupiter and certainly beyond Pluto's orbit, they're just far too faint. We don't study them, so we don't even know their properties. So to say that Oumuamua is exceptional in any way is comparing it to nothing but itself.
Grant, it seems that that Oumuamua is a surprise object. That's what I get anyway from Colbert's article, is that this is a surprise object. You had mentioned to me earlier that the instrument that spotted this is a new instrument.
Relatively new.
5 years old, you had said.
I think it's more like 10. So Pan-STARRS got going about in about 2010. And the fact is, they did not expect to see anything like this. They thought that Pan-STARRS was not going to be sensitive enough to see these kinds of objects. But like I said, this sort of came through in the sweet spot. And lo and behold, it's there. I mean, the fact is, you don't know in astronomy what you're going to see until you look. And we opened our eyes in a new way, put on a new set of glasses, metaphorically, to look at the universe. And frankly, I'm not surprised we found something exceptional. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited that we found this, because it spurned a great debate about objects moving between solar systems, and even possibly whether Oumuamua actually belongs to our solar system all along. And so there's an enormous amount of study yet to be done, and so much more for us to learn about these kinds of objects.
So you're of the position that this is clear evidence of alien life in space is a little premature.
I absolutely don't think the evidence is there to say that this is an alien ship. I think there are good reasons to think that there could be aliens in our galaxy, and we could talk about those arguments if we have time. But I don't think this anywhere near clears the bar for evidence that there are aliens that produced it. I think there are too many natural explanations. And frankly, there's enough that we don't know about this population of objects so that we can't say whether it's so rare that only an alien could have made it, or maybe it's a very natural occurring thing that occurs either in other solar systems that come here or occurs in the outskirts of our own solar system.
Grant, almost everyone that I know anyway wants to believe that we're not alone here. They want to believe that we're part of a broader community, even if it's microbes out there. What evidence or what indications would you cite that say either no, we're probably pretty much alone here, or there's a lot of life out there somewhere?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm with y'all. I want to believe that life is prevalent throughout our galaxy and our universe. That would be just great. I think that for me, the sheer numbers sell me on that idea. And I'll talk about a conflicting idea to that in a moment. But the sheer numbers are amazing. And Elizabeth Colbert does talk about this in her article. But we have approximately 100 billion stars in our galaxy. As we do planet searches around other stars, what are called extrasolar planets, we now know of over 4,000 of them. And it looks like, on average, most stars have planets. So if there's 100 billion planets out there, or if stars have multiple planets, maybe many more than 100 billion planets, then the question is how many of them can support life, what kind of life, and so on. And the numbers are absolutely, I hate to use this term, but they are astronomical. All right, so if life occurs by chance, even if the probability of getting life is pretty low for a given planet, we have so many opportunities for it to happen in our galaxy that it seems to me just bound to happen in other places. All right, but there's a great argument by Enrico Fermi, which is very succinct, that argues against that. And Enrico Fermi just said, well, where are they? And the fact is, you can sit down and you can work out how long it would take for humans to colonize the entire galaxy. And I mean every planet in the galaxy. And the number is being, and I won't go through the argument for you, but the number works out to be a few tens of millions of years. All right, now that sounds like a long time compared to a human lifetime. But I'll remind you that the dinosaurs owned the Earth for something like 200 million years. And so the dinosaurs could have, so if we live as long as the dinosaurs, we could colonize the galaxy many, many times over. So if that's true for us, we expect that would be true for any intelligent species like us. We think that natural selection selects for intelligence. I mean, that would make sense. And so then the question is just, well, all right, where are they? We've painted this picture that they should be all over the place, but yet we haven't interacted with them yet that we know of, at least not in a scientifically believable way. So, and just to throw out one more idea about that, because one big thought is, well, all the aliens have decided that they will not, they're just gonna leave Earth alone until we're mature enough. And unfortunately, there's a strong argument against that theory, which is the one bad apple ruins the bunch theory. And so you have to invent a pretty weird collective Milky Way alien sociology to not have one bad alien civilization that wants to come to Earth and ruin the surprise. So here we are. I don't know. It would be great if Oumuamua was a spaceship. I just don't see it in the evidence.
Well, Grant, I appreciate your coming on the program today. And
oh, that's my pleasure. This was a lot of fun. Thanks.
I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today on Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.